The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan, and on the Breakfast Grill with me today is a Guy Standing Professor of Development Studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies, the University of London, and also co-founder of the Basic Income Earth Network. He's also the author of the recently released book, The Corruption of Capitalism, Why Rentiers Thrive and Work Does Not Pay. He's also well known for his 2001 work, The Precariat, The New Dangerous Class. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
It's a pleasure.
Professor Stanley, I want to begin by asking you what your book sets out to describe and argue for.
Well, very schematically, what it does is challenge the orthodox claim that we are seeing globalization developing a free market economy. And the corruption idea is that despite all the protestations of people saying they believe in free markets and open markets, what in fact has been taking place is precisely the opposite. One could claim that we're seeing the construction of the most unfree global market that's ever existed. And that's the essence of the initial claim. What happened basically is that approximately 30 years ago, we had the beginnings of globalization, a term that everybody uses, and it began with the triumph of a smallish group of economists, mostly on the political right, people like Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman and so on, who pushed an agenda of what we now call neoliberalism. And what it involved was a deliberate attempt to privatize as much as possible, to introduce market forces more and more, to break up old nationalized systems, old forms of regulation, and so on. And for a while, we saw the beginnings of opening markets, opening labor markets, opening capital markets, opening financial markets, and so on. But this ushered in a period in which financial institutions became very, very strong, and powerful corporations combined with political developments like Thatcher and Reagan and so on, gradually constructed a global architecture in which the institutions at the global level, including the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, gradually created an architecture which protected property rights. And most fundamentally of all, what has happened is that a little organization that I remember in Geneva being a rather joke organization because it had a funny name, it sounded like a detergent, it was called WIPO. And WIPO has become the most powerful setter of rules relating to intellectual property. And it's WIPO stands for the World Intellectual Property Organization. And what happened was in 1995, and I don't want to bore your listeners with too many details, but they essentially introduced another acronym called TRIPS, Trade-Related Aspects of Property Rights. And that vastly strengthened patents, copyright, industrial brands, and so on. Now, you have to realize that when a corporation or an individual, but it's going to be a corporation mostly, they register a patent, what that means is they get a guaranteed monopoly income on that product or process for 20 years. So in other words, nobody else is allowed to produce that product or use that process unless they pay a lot of money to somebody who owns the patent. Now, before 1995, fewer than 1 million patents were filed with WIPO each year. Well, last year was the first year in which more than 3 million were filed. And what's been happening is that the biggest plutocratic corporations, mostly in Silicon Valley and in New York, have been buying up thousands of patents and stringing them together and turning the resultant monopoly control of whole processes like Amazon, like Google, like Apple into monopoly income flows of vast amounts. So what we've been seeing is a fundamental breakdown of the income distribution system of the 20th century, in which it has been roughly accepted, very roughly, that the share of national income, be it in a country like Malaysia or in the United States or Britain, the share going to capital and the share going to labor were roughly constant. They fluctuated a bit, but the shares were roughly constant. Well, in the last 30 years, what's been happening is that the share going to capital has been shooting up all over the world, including China, including the United States and all of the European Union. The share going to capital is going up. The share going to labor has been going down. And within the growing share going to capital, the share going to the rentiers, the people who have property, financial, intellectual, or physical, has been shooting up. And many countries, including Malaysia, have been becoming almost rentier economies. They're making vast amounts of money through the ownership of property. Now, of course, this is fundamentally different from the idea of an open market system where competition takes place between people on price and quality, competing with one another if you have a lockdown on the extent of competition, then you're actually reducing the market system. And this has been protected by well over 3,000 trade and investment agreements, which aren't really about trade. They're about protecting property rights. And at the top of the tree, or the cherry on the cake, if you like, is another acronym called the ISDS, the Investor-State Dispute Settlement. So corporations can sue a government if, in their opinion, the government is doing policies which would affect their future profits. Now, this is ridiculous. We don't have a chance as individuals to take our governments to court because they introduce policies that might affect our future incomes. If we did, we'd be very rich, or you'd have total paralysis of governments. So this system is being protected in a way, and especially as the corporations get to appoint one of the judges, so that it's a closed system, really. The other end of the scale, wages have been stagnating in the OECD countries, so that we're seeing downward pressure on workers' wages in all rich industrialized countries, and particularly for the group that I've been writing about, the precariat.
Now, can I sort of introduce into this the experience that us in Southeast Asia and in the countries of Northeast Asia and China in particular that we are familiar with, where the last 30 Yep. years has seen an extraordinary explosion in terms of personal wealth, of raising millions, hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And we have those stories over and over again, India as well. And so, you know, this time period over which you sketch these dynamics that you just stated, we have a success story.
It's an exact mirror image. I mean, I worked in Malaysia during the 1980s and part of the 90s, in which I saw this process taking off and huge rapid growth, huge absorption of young women in particular in the export zones. And we saw an economic dynamism taking off. One of the ironies, and I've seen that in China and I'm seeing it in India today, where economic growth is 8% or more, maybe in this year, what we're seeing is globalization has led to a surge of economic growth. I always laugh at people who claim that globalization has lowered growth. Well, it's lowered growth in rich industrialized countries, but if you look at it from a global perspective, and you think of China and India and the whole of your region, you see that actually growth has been more rapid than at any time. But the problem has been that, of course, the concentration of the gains has been disgracefully inegalitarian, if you like. We see the emergence of a plutocracy about which I've been writing, plutocracy of absurdly wealthy billionaires in whatever currency you're thinking, whose main income now comes from various forms of rent, which I document in the books. And what you've seen is that you've got a sort of global plutocracy who are linked internationally through connections with financial institutions like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and other financial institutions. And you're seeing rises in wages, but very onerous working conditions continuing in many of the countries where growth has been extremely rapid. So you've seen a vast increase in wealth inequality, often with growing income inequality. Now, I think that this process will continue for some time to come because the wages in China and India in particular and Vietnam are still well below what they are in Western Europe. So you're going to see a continuing convergence. But when I was working in the Prime Minister's department back in the late 1980s, I organized a huge survey of factories across Malaysia, and 3,000 altogether. And it was clear even then that the flexible labor system meant that numerous people were suffering from various forms of insecurity. And that flexible labor market has ushered in the growth of the precariat. And it's a global phenomenon. So I've just supervised a dissertation where documenting the growth of a precariat in the cities and towns of China. And millions of people are insecure in various ways. They don't feel they're developing their lives, they're developing their competencies, that they're feeling they belong to a cultural organization or body that gives them real meaning. And they're losing standard rights of citizenship in various ways, often not realizing until they come to need them. So the downside of this is that while the rentiers are racing ahead, making vast amounts of money and exercising political power, and this is a global phenomenon, we find the precariat is also a global phenomenon, and the political consequences of that include the drift to far-right populism in a number of countries, including the United States, with the election of Donald Trump. And we've got an unsustainable economic and political situation that's emerging.
I'm speaking to Guy Standing, Professor of Development Studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. He's also the author of the recently released book, The Corruption of Capitalism, Why Rentiers Thrive and Work Does Not Pay. He's also well known for his 2001 work, The Precariat, The New Dangerous Class. Next up, we look at the radical proposal for a universal basic income. I'm Sharad Kutan, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning. If you just joined us, I'm Sharad Kutan, and my guest this morning is Guy Standing, Professor of Development Studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London, the author of the book, The Corruption of Capitalism, Why Rentiers Thrive and Work Does Not Pay. At his Harvard commencement address, Mark Zuckerberg, the billionaire founder of Facebook, said that we should explore ideas like universal basic income to make sure that everyone has a cushion to try new ideas. And he spun it in the direction of creativity and innovation. But is the universal basic income proposal really about that?
Well, I think that's why I say there's a perfect storm of factors that have suddenly made it possible for people like me to discuss basic income with a wide variety of different people. That's why I was invited to Davos this year to talk about basic income, which I would never have expected 5 years or 10 years ago.
Is it similar to the welfare state? Is it similar to the dole of giving out checks?
No. The idea is that every individual, every man, every woman, and every child, with the amount paid to the mother, should receive each month a modest cash-based amount, a basic income, without conditions. So they can actually spend it as they wish and use it as they wish. Now, that sounds quite radical, but it's not the same as a welfare state, which links payments to particular forms of contingency. On top of that basic income, you would have, you know, supplements for people with disabilities, supplements for people, for women with children or on maternity leave or frail elderly situations. Of course, it's not a panacea, but basically the idea is that it's a matter of social justice, first of all, because the income and wealth of everybody, you and me included, and every listener, is far more to do with the efforts of our ancestors and going back many generations. And in a sense, none of us get our income and wealth entirely by our own efforts. And if you accept private inheritance, then you can say we ought to have a share, a social dividend on the collective wealth of society paid out to everybody. And that's the first justification. The second justification is that a basic income would enhance people's personal freedom, the ability to say no to oppressive, exploitative relationships, the ability to make choices and to take entrepreneurial type of risks more easily, and it would provide for across the whole of society. Now, you could tax back from the wealthy with a higher rate of taxation, so it doesn't mean that you're giving to millionaires as such, but it's much easier to operate administratively and to make it a right if everybody receives it, and it's much cheaper and more efficient, whereas the idea of means testing creates what we call poverty traps, where going from receiving a modest income into a job, you actually face marginal tax rates, very high rates. So a basic income is something that would be paid individually and would be a modest amount. Now, the third reason, and you've touched on it, is that a basic income would give people a sense of basic security. Not total security, but basic security. And what we know from psychological research, from our pilots in India and Africa and so on, is that people who have basic income security have better mental health. They're more able to make longer-term strategic decisions. They have mental calm, and they tend to be more tolerant of others, more altruistic. And it turns out that the evidence is overwhelming, and I've summarized it in a new book. The evidence is overwhelming that people who have basic security actually work more, not less. They are not only harder working, but they're more productive when they work. They're more cooperative if they have basic security behind them. But it doesn't act as an inducement to laziness or idleness, because 99% of people in every society where I've ever worked or lived want to improve their lives. They want to improve their lives from where they are at this moment, and nobody that in sensible society is going to just be able to rely on a modest basic income. They'll want to improve their lives. So, in fact, it's an energizing measure. We've done big pilot in India where we provided 6,000 people with a basic income, and we monitored that over 2 years. And one of the outcomes that was most striking was that the amount of work increased, not went down.
Lastly, Professor Standing, if you were advising the Malaysian government, a government that's committed to development, whose political legitimacy is based on a growing pie distributed across ethnic communities, allowing individuals to plug into global consumerism, what would you say to such a group of leaders about where to, and how to respond to these latest trends?
Oh, I think that they must have more confidence in the capacities of all communities in Malaysia. We know the historical background, we know the tensions that have always existed, and I think that introducing a trend towards a basic income would be a way of stating and committing to a greater sense of unity, a greater sense of social solidarity, in which it would increase the abilities of local communities to forge communities, to strengthen communities. And I don't regard a basic income as a standalone policy. I think governments have to introduce other measures. But we're going to have to realize that growing inequality of wealth and income, with the growing tendency of that inevitably to lead to more corruption of democracy, whatever the euphemisms you wish to use, has to be reversed. We have to reverse it, and measures that can build a new income distribution system will be necessary. And a country like Malaysia, which is in the middle of rapid development and is a middle-income country, if you like, has to take a lead in constructing a new system which is suitable to a global 21st century economy. And I would urge them to seriously think about this.
Thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for listening.
I've been speaking to Guy Standing, Professor of Development Studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies, the author of the book, The Corruption of Capitalism, Why Rentiers Thrive and Work Does Not Pay. You've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Sharad Kutan on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.